Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
This podcast is brought to you by Purposefully Different Productions and is proudly sponsored by Little Dish, makers of delicious fresh meals for kids that are an absolute lifesaver on busy days. I love these meals because they are different to other kids' meals out there. They include a variety of ingredients, lots of textures, and are made with little taste buds in mind. Before we get started on today's episode, here's a word from our friend Giovanna Fletcher.
At Little Dish, we've spent years perfecting delicious, healthy, fresh meals guaranteed to be eaten by kids. Except when you sprinkle cheese on top instead of letting them do it, or if the Little Dish is served on the red plate or the yellow plate or the blue plate, or when you talk over them, or when they can't wear their Ranger antlers because it's summer and they're in the loft, or on Mondays or on Tuesdays, Wednesdays, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and potentially even Sundays. Good luck and Godspeed. Little Dish. Healthy food kids love. Find us in the chilled aisle.
Hello and welcome back to How to Feed with me, Charlotte Sterling Reed, the parenting podcast that brings you reassurance, confidence, and practical advice on feeding your baby, toddler, and the whole family. Today's episode is such an important one because we're diving into how children learn to eat, why some children find eating so difficult, and how we as parents can tell the difference between typical fussy eating and some of the more complex feeding challenges. To help us understand all of this, I am joined by the incredible Dr. Kay Toomey, a pediatric psychologist and the creator of the SOS Approach to Feeding, an internationally respected program that supports children with significant feeding challenges. Based out in Colorado in the US, Dr. Kay is joining us virtually, and I'm beyond excited to say hello, Dr. Kay Toomey. Thank you so much for joining me. I've been following what you've been doing for a long time. Fascinated. Absolutely love it. I'd love for you to just tell my audience in the UK here a little bit about your work and what you do, if that's okay.
So the SOS Approach to Feeding is a program that I have created over the past 35 years. It was originally developed with a group of various therapists and physicians. So it is and started as a multidisciplinary approach, but it's really evolved into a transdisciplinary approach. And so the SOS Approach to Feeding, SOS stands for Sequential Oral Sensory. Mm-hmm. Those are the major components of the program. Mm-hmm. But SOS, of course, also stands for Save Our Ship. Mm-hmm. And that's because we really want to be that lifeline to families who have children who are struggling with their eating and with their growth. Because I like to talk about the fact that there's not a lot we do as parents multiple times a day where we have the privilege of feeling like a failure. Mm. And when your child doesn't eat well, that really impacts not only them, but also impacts you as a parent. It impacts your family. And as I said, we really want to be that lifeline to the families. And so that is the goal of the program. We are a play-based program. We are based on what we as rehabilitation therapists understand and know so well, which is that children learn best through play. Mm-hmm. And that if we want to help children develop a healthy lifelong relationship with food, we need to teach them the skills they need to eat in a way that makes the most sense for them and is the most fun for them.
Yeah.
So that they want to do it. They want to be engaged. Mm-hmm. Because eating is actually a learned skill. Mm. So many people think eating is automatic. It's instinctive. It happens no matter what. And the research simply doesn't support any of those statements. Yeah. And we know that it is a developmental process. And as long as everything's going great with your development, things should move forward, hopefully well. And if you're struggling a little bit within any of those developmental has journeys that we go on in the course of learning how to start from being a baby to moving through life. We know that those children are going to struggle with their feeding potentially because it is something we do over and over again, and it is a skill children have to learn. So the program is really about teaching the children the skills in a way that works best for them and whatever developmental path that they're on, and to also hopefully help that fit within the family and what works best for the family. So that's kind of a overview of the program.
Yeah, I love that. And your kind of background before you did the SOS feeding therapy, because I mean, I definitely wanted to talk to you about that, and also so many little things that you picked out there. But yeah, what about your background? What did you do before you developed that?
So I'm actually a pediatric psychologist by training, which in the mid 1980s was a bit of a different discipline to get involved in the field. And I originally got involved in the field because I was asked to see a young child who was 2.5 years of age. She had just had a gastrostomy tube placed. And in the mid 1980s, we didn't have the cute little G buttons that most of the children have now. We used to take an adult urine Foley catheter. We would stitch it into the child's stomach. We'd put a hemostat clamp on the end of it to make sure nothing leaked out. And that was my first experience with a child who didn't eat well. In the mid 1980s, that was a fairly big surgery. And fortunately, the prevailing belief of the medical community at the time was that when a child doesn't eat well, it's the parent's fault. It's something about the parents that are causing this issue. And so I was basically told by my medical team, you're the psychologist, you go fix this family. And so I went into this situation, had no idea anything about feeding. Went in with my psychological assessments, my attachment assessments, all of those things. I'm doing all this testing with the family and the child, and something's not fitting with this picture because I have this warm, delightful, well-adjusted set of parents who were doing everything anyone asked them to do, who were very well attached to their child. The child was well attached to them. But we had a child who had a developmental delay, and nobody even considered that that was the possible cause of why this child wasn't able to eat what everyone thought a typically developing 2.5-year-old would be able to eat. And that's what got me as a psychologist interested in the field, because I wanted to understand why, when children don't eat, do we as professionals blame parents? Because that did not fit with what I was seeing in this particular circumstance. And what the research over the years has actually shown is that 97 to 93% of the time, when a child doesn't eat well, there is something physically going on with the child that's not quite working correctly. And that families are the cause of children's feeding issues in only about 3 to 7% of the cases. And when I teach our program to other professionals, I start off our teaching courses by talking to professionals about if we as professionals think the parents are causing this child to have a feeding issue, we are going to be wrong 93 to 97% of the time. And so my first piece of advice to professionals is don't go there. Don't go there because you're going to be wrong 93 to 97% of the time. Feeding is so much more complicated than what we used to think about feeding and how many people think about feeding. When feeding goes well, we don't think about it, we just do it. When feeding doesn't go well, that's when we really have to understand what's going on. And what we know is eating is actually the most complicated human activity that we engage in. And it is the only thing we do as human organisms where we have to simultaneously integrate information across 7 different areas of human function. So the body has to be working well across those 7 areas of human function. And then we have to be able to integrate within each of those seven areas and across each of those seven areas in order to make eating and growth go well. And so it's so incredibly more complicated than what people think.
Because I was going to ask about that. I think you're absolutely right. Many parents assume that feeding is a skill that they just will automatically pick up, but this is just not the case. And it's actually something I'm often trying to get across to parents. You know, feeding is so complicated, and it, like you say, it is a skill they have to learn. And you know, when we talk about weaning, this is what weaning is about. It's just like, you know, when we expect children to walk or talk or crawl, we don't expect them to go like that. And this is exactly the same, right? This is a skill that babies are learning, and it takes time. So I was going to ask, on top of that, are there some kind of key milestone ages for babies when this feeding really kicks in, you know, the suckling or learning to eat? Are there really key milestones in a children's life that parents ought to be aware of?
Absolutely. So the first one that's important for everybody to understand is that when you're born, we should be born with an appetite instinct. Mother Nature tries to help us survive. Yeah. We're born not only with a pretty hefty appetite drive, we're also born with a set of primitive motor reflexes that are going to help us continue to eat, because at about 4 to 6 weeks of age, that appetite drive seems to lessen a little bit, and those primitive motor reflexes take over as the primary driver of eating. So eating, we say, is driven predominantly by appetite instinct only for the first 4 to 6 weeks of our life. So if we're older than 4 to 6 weeks of age, we can no longer use instinct as an excuse for overeating.
Because
that instinct is not that strong anymore if you're older than 4 to 6 weeks of age. Primitive motor reflexes, most families are familiar with what's called the rooting reflex. So if you stroke a baby's cheek, they will turn, open their mouth so that they can latch onto the breast. My favorite is called the palmamental reflex. If you put your finger in the middle of a baby's palm,
they will
close their fingers around your, or their fingers around your finger. What most people don't realize is the baby also opens their mouth in the palmamental, because it's another way to help with latching. So those primitive motor reflexes Mother Nature puts in place so that we can continue to eat for the first 4 to 6 months of our life. So we have that first 4 to 6 months of our life where we're supposed to take these reflexes that we're born with and bring them under voluntary muscle motor control. Because around somewhere around 4 to 6 months of age, 3 to 5 months of age, those primitive motor reflexes begin to go away. So that after 6 months of age, we no longer have those reflexes in place. And so if you have not been awake, alert, working on bringing those reflexes under voluntary control, at 6 months of age, when your reflexes go away, sometimes children's eating goes away. And around the world, the most common second age to get a gastrostomy tube placed, if you don't get it in early infancy, especially if you're born in premature and in the NICU, is 7 months of age. And so the first milestone is 4 to 6 weeks when those reflexes take over, the appetite drive lessens. The second major milestone is 4 to 6 months of age when those reflexes get integrated, brought under voluntary control. So that after 6 months of age, eating is a voluntary behavior, and you only have three choices. You either learn to eat as it's a skill, you learn to not eat because things aren't going well, or you learn to kind of sort of eat because some things are going well, some things are not going so well. So that's the second major milestone. The next one is going to be 12 to 14 months of age. Because between 12 and 14 months of age is when children become self-aware And when children become self-aware, they realize they have their own opinions about things. They also are trying to assert themselves and begin to do things themselves. And so that one easy way to assert myself as a 12-month-old is to not do what you want me to, mom and dad. And that includes deciding sometimes I have better things to do than eat. When I become self-aware, there's this whole world out there for me to explore. I have better things to do this eating thing. I
Absolutely.
have more exciting things to do than to do this eating thing. And so you'll see that sometimes children will just decide they're not going to eat. They theoretically are also learning to walk. And the combination of sometimes deciding not to eat and learning to walk, so they're burning more calories, means we see developmentally this reflected in all children's growth curves. So children's growth curves go up, 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 up exponentially, very steeply. At 12 months of age, everybody's growth curve takes a right-hand turn and goes like this. And it's because of this developmental stage. And the second most common age to get a G-tube placed around the world is 14 to 16 months of age. Because if I have a child who's become self-aware, wants to do it themselves, has good skills, they will be able to continue to advance to a table food diet. If I have a child who's self-aware, but whose body isn't quite working well, who doesn't have the best skills, we're now going to have a mismatch between the child wanting to do it themselves, but actually not being able to do it well themselves. And we start to see children begin to fall behind. And so that's the next third important milestone. The next important milestone is going to be our terrific twos. And it's called the terrible twos for a reason. And that, of course, is the major next stage of what we call separation and individuation. So at 12 to 14 months of age, we become self-aware that we're our own organism on the planet. At two, we become aware who are we as our own separate person, different from our primary caregiver, whoever our primary attachment caregiver is. And again, the best way for me to see myself, express myself as being separate than my primary attachment caregiver, is not just to do things different than you want me to, but to actually do the exact opposite.
To oppose, exactly.
This is part of what makes the twos so challenging for everyone, is that they are asserting themselves by doing the opposite of what we want them to. And there's another major issue going on between 2 and 3 years of age. Children are making a cognitive shift in the way they understand the world. So we talk about children from birth until 2 to 3 years of age are in a stage of what we call sensory motor understanding of the world. What that means is the only way they understand the world is based on how the world physically impacts on their body. So young children don't have what we call theory of mind. They don't think in words and pictures like what you and I do. They understand and think in the world in physical sensations. But between 2 and 3 years of age, children are going to make this big cognitive leap from sensory motor thinking into pre-logical thinking, where language comes on board, imagination comes on board, theory of mind comes on board, and children begin to think in words and pictures. This major cognitive transition is known as a touch point. So the pediatrician in the US, Barry Brazelton, talked about this idea of a touch point. He actually has a book called Touch Points, where children have certain times in development where they make big developmental leaps forward. And during those time periods, it's almost like they can only concentrate on that developmental leap. And another part of development actually regresses for a little bit. And when children are making big cognitive leaps forward,
Yeah.
the part of development we see regress is their sensory integration
Okay.
capabilities.
Yeah.
And so their ability to tolerate sensory experiences gets worse for a little while. The reason why that is important from a feeding standpoint is because eating is a hugely sensory experience. And if your sensory systems aren't working well, then eating doesn't go well. And when your sensory systems don't go well, what you do is you want to eat the same foods over and over again, because if you give me my perfect isosceles triangle grilled cheese sandwich, no crust, lightly toasted, no brown spots, only one slice of only the orange cheddar cheese, not the white cheddar cheese, at body temperature, I don't have to turn on my sensory brain to eat that food, do I? And so what happens between 2 and 3 is parents, well, we know 50% of parents, based on the research, are going to say that their 2 to 3 year old is picky. And what they mean by their child being picky is that their child wants to eat the same exactly perfectly prepared food over and over again. And so we see that there is this surge in pickiness between 2 to 3 years of age because of these developmental changes, where children are making this big mental leap forward, their sensory re systems regress. And the way we, one of the ways we see that displayed is in them becoming very persnickety about how their food looks, how their food smells, how their food feels, whether it's my same exact perfect way I want to have it. And when it's not in the way I want it, what do I do as a 2-year-old? I throw a temper tantrum.
I
What
refer
do we do
to
as parents? As parents, we're like, okay, if you want to have chicken nuggets every day for lunch, let's just do that to get you to eat. Well, it's a short-term fix that causes a long-term problem, because unfortunately, your brain is a use it or lose it organ system. And so if you stop using your sensory brain at every meal because your parents have given you your perfect food, because if you have your perfect food, you don't have
Don't
to
need
turn
to.
on your sensory brain. What happens is you lose the pathways for being able to sensorially manage
Other
other
foods.
versions of foods. And so a child may go into this 2 to 3 year shift with maybe 30 foods in their food repertoire. But what they do between 2 and 3 is they do what we call food jagging. So a food jag is when the child wants to eat the same food over and over again, prepared the exact same way. What happens to most children is they get sick and tired of that food eventually. They burn out on it and they don't want to eat it anymore. And so they may end up at 3 years of age having lost 10 foods out of their food repertoire due to burnout. And now I have a child who has only 20 foods in their food repertoire. Now, an important thing to understand about food jagging is that most of us do it. All of us did it during the pandemic. As adults, we talk about it as eating comfort food. And we know from the research that a third of typically developing children are also going to food jag. So when a child eats the same food over and over again and eventually burns out on it, or as an adult, we burn out on it, if we don't have an active feeding problem, we can take about a 2 week break from a food that we've gotten sick and tired of. And after about 2 weeks of having a rest from that food, we'll come back and eat that food again. That's not what children who have feeding problems do. For children who have feeding problems, if they've food jagged and burned out on a food, if you give them a 2 week break from that food and you try to re-present it, they will either act like they've never seen that food before in their lifetime, even though they just spent the last 3 years having
Eating it,
peanut butter and honey sandwiches on wheat bread for school lunch, they'll act like they've never seen it before in their entire lifetime. Or they'll act like it's the most evil, disgusting thing on the planet you could possibly feed them.
Yes.
So children who have active feeding problems, when they burn out on a food, it gets lost out of the repertoire. Whereas those of us who are more typically developing, if we get sick and tired of a food, as long as you give us a rest, we'll come back
We'll
and
come
eat it
back to
again.
it. Yeah.
And so it does become one of those hallmarks to help us understand the severity of a child's feeding difficulty.
Okay. So it's a real, because I definitely want to talk about like flags and the feeding difficulties in a minute. But I think, first of all, what you've said here, I find fascinating because you've really pinpointed these specific moments. And I think a lot of parents listening will go, it explains a lot, you know. Oh, that makes so much sense. And I think the fact that when we're parents, we aren't told that information, that these different kind of milestones happen, that there's different times when actually our children's brains are going to be developing and wired and changing. And it would help so much because I feel like a lot of parents go through these phases and they, like you said, they blame themselves. They think, oh God, I've done it all wrong. I've got to change things up. And that's often where you then get a problem. So, with that in mind, what I wanted to ask was, you mentioned about it obviously not being parents' faults, but what kind of role can we play as parents and caregivers in shaping our children's eating during these kind of milestones?
Yes. Let me put that question on hold for just one second because I need to deliver a little bit of not great news. And that is, there's two more critical shifts.
Oh, sorry, carry on. I'm so sorry. I've interrupted too
Not
soon.
actually out of the woods at three, because there is another big cognitive shift that happens between 5 and 7 years of age, and yet another one at 9 to 11 years of age. So you're not out of the woods until they're about 12 or 13. And so I know that's going to be really hard for families to hear. And the shift between 5 to 7 and 9 to 11 are exactly what we just talked about with the 2 to 3 year old shift. 5 to 7, children are shifting out of pre-logical thinking into logical thinking. Their sensory systems all regress and they want to food jag again. They get picky again with their eating. At 9 to 11, they shift out of logical thinking into abstract thought. Their sensory systems regress and they get picky again about their eating. So, one of the biggest things that families can do during these transition time periods is to think about how do I help my children's sensory systems continue to function well. So, certainly, if the child is really struggling, we can think about putting them in sensory therapy. But there's a number of other things that families can do to help children's sensory systems work well. And the biggest, most important thing that they can do is to give their children as much physical experiences that are different during these time periods to keep all their sensory systems working. So we have eight sensory systems, not five, like you're taught in school. And so we need to have physical exercise for our children. We need to not be letting them sit and be on iPhones, iPads, in front of the television, especially during these ages. They need to get outside. They need to have sensory inputs coming into all the senses of the body. We need to engage them in different kinds of arts and crafts activities so that they are getting their hands in things. They're seeing different things, smelling different things. We can also, as parents, really engage them in cooking with us so that they're not only having those multi-sensory experiences, hopefully they're also going to be willing to do some tasting along the way because there's not a lot of physical activities we do that involve tasting. But ideally, especially during these transition times, we want our children engaging in activities that activate all eight of the senses. So smell and taste in addition to seeing, hearing, touching, and the three sensory systems that people don't typically learn about in school is we have a sense that's called proprioception. And proprioception is deep pressure into the muscles and joints. It tells us how heavy something is, how light something is, what kind of surface we're walking on, sitting on. It tells us about our body moving in space. That's why physical exercise is so important for young children. Also, deep pressure into your muscles and joints is the most calming of all your sensory activities. It's why we like massages. It's why we feel better after we exercise. It's why we all engage in nervous habits, like we click our pens, we bounce our knee, we swing our foot, we, you know, tap our pens, we bite our nails, we pull our hair. All of that is proprioceptive seeking behavior, grinding your teeth. So proprioception is so important for development. The other two senses have to do with your vestibular sense. So that's your sense of balance. And then the third sense is called interoception. And interoception is your ability to read your internal body signals. And so, of course, for feeding, the important thing is understanding when you're hungry and when you're full, when you're thirsty, when you're no longer thirsty. But there's six categories in interoception that the children have to understand about their bodies. And so we can get our kids moving during those times, and that will really make a big difference in helping them get through these transition stages. As I said, cooking with them is an important thing to do. By the age of five, we would like children actually acting as your sous chef for at least one meal a week for your family, where they're kind of acting as your junior chef. By the age of seven, we would actually like your child being the main chef for one meal a week for your family, so that you're the sous chef, because of course we don't want them unsupervised in the kitchen, but we want them involved in thinking about the food and the planning and actually cooking, because we need children to be learning that you can eat most anything on the planet. It all depends on how you prepare it. And that if you're not sure about a food as a child that's being presented with you, you can figure out ways to fix it and make it work for your body, so that children go into learning how to eat more and more what we would think about as grown-up foods with confidence. Oh, I can do this. I can make this work. I can, if it didn't work the first time, I can figure out how to make it work the next time. And so that's some of the big overarching things to think about. As families. Of course, other things we want to do as families is we want to do family meals. I'm sure your families have heard that before. And I really want to re-emphasize here the importance of the fact that when you have a child who isn't learning to eat the way you want them to, they're not learning to eat the foods you want them to. The way they're going to learn to do that is by you, the parent, teaching them to do that.
Absolutely.
And so in SOS, we talk about the fact that as families, as parents, so often we come to the table trying to be dietitians. Did my child get enough milk? Did they get enough protein? Have they gotten enough, you know, magnesium from their green vegetables or, you know, vitamin K from, you know, their orange vegetables? And we don't want parents coming to the table being dietitians. We have dietitians and nutritionists out there. They are phenomenal at their jobs. We need to talk to them and let them do their job. We need to shift how we think as parents when we come to the table. We need to not come to the table thinking about the volume and exactly what our children are eating. What we need to think about as parents is coming to the table as being teachers. If we have a child who hasn't learned to eat what we want them to eat, We have to teach them
Yeah.
how to eat those.
How to do it. So essentially, it's the majority of that is in role modeling. It's not about worrying what they're having, how much they're having, the nutritional content. It's teaching them to eat and enjoy food by modeling.
Exactly. We want to think about every meal is class. You are the professor, your child is the student, food is your subject. So the first thing is you better talk about your subject. How many families sit down to the table, never talk about the food? They don't talk about what color it is. They don't talk about why would you eat liver and onions? But saying it's good for you isn't good enough for most kids. It has a lot of iron in it. Iron helps our blood be strong. We need to role model, but we also need to teach. And the best way to teach is by what I call show and tell. So, and we tell parents, mealtime, it's show and tell time. You need to put on your happy face and you need to show the children how to eat it and you need to talk about the food. And especially if you have a child who has some skill deficits, you need to show them how to eat it in a way that's over-exaggerated. We talk about, I can take a bite and put it on my strong back teeth. My front teeth is for biting. My back teeth are for chewing. And so we have to explain it and then open our mouths and show them. So manners come after learning the skill. We talk about eating comes first. Then comes manners. So you may have to open your mouth to show your child where the food is, how you're chewing it up, how much chewing a certain food takes. So it's not just role modeling eating the carrot, it's role modeling.
How to eat. Yeah, I mean, I talk a huge amount about this in the work that I do. So I'm really glad that you're reiterating, the family, the eating together, the modeling. And I think that is really important. Can I ask, I know that you specialize or you work around pediatric feeding disorder, ARFID. I mean, obviously everything you said really is just so fascinating, but generally, but can we delve in a little bit to PFD and ARFID and first of all, I guess what they are for people who have never heard of them? Would you be happy to explain that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Can I make one more comment about us as parents at the
Of
mealtime?
course, absolutely.
Is if I want families to think about who are the best professors you learned from in school, in university? Was it the professor who said to you, sit down, be quiet, do this worksheet? No. The best professors you learned from were the ones who were fun, the ones who were funny. The ones who made it enjoyable, the ones who showed you and told you in a simplistic fashion how to do this. And so I really want to encourage parents to think about if you're coming to the table, changing who you are at the table at to be a professor, what's the kind of professor you want to be?
Yeah, love that.
That will help families, I think, be able to be more free, to be relaxed.
And enjoy those meal times together.
Exactly. And to enjoy the experience together, of learning together.
Yeah, I love that idea of thinking about your, lectures or who, people who you learn from, because you're so right. The ones that stick in your mind are the ones who are entertaining and engaging and sort of brought it to an interesting level rather than the ones that like read it off a script and no one's taking anything in. That's really, really great.
Who figured out how you learn?
Yeah,
Who figured out
exactly.
how to make it sense to you?
Yeah, for
Be
sure.
because it, you know, different children learn differently. So as parents, we have to think about what do we need to do to make this make sense to our child and how they learn best about the world, whether they are neurodiverse or not.
Yeah,
All children
any children.
have a best way to
Yeah.
learn. And as parents, that's part of being a good teacher, right? Is figuring out how, what's the best way to teach your students.
Yeah, love that. Amazing. Thank you for filling that point in. But yeah, so I'd love to delve into pediatric feeding disorder and ARFID. And I think especially for parents who maybe haven't come across them before, and of course, like the differences between maybe like neurotypical or your kind of typical child feeding, it would be so great to explore that if that's okay.
Yes. So, we talk about there's sort of three levels. There is the picky eater
Yep.
who really and truly is going through a stage and is going to be able to get better on their own. We know from the research around the world, there are 25 to 33% of the world's children will experience some kind of picky eating in the first decade of their life. We also know from the research that only about, again, a third to a half of those children are going to completely independently get through that stage and not have any picky eating left over. So this idea that all children are picky is not exactly correct. So when people say, oh, don't worry about it, all kids are picky, that simply is not true. It's not supported by the research. The research shows that a quarter to a third of the world's children will experience picky eating at some point in the first decade of their life. Then many times parents are told, oh, and if your child is picky, they'll outgrow it. All kids outgrow their picky eating. Well, that's not true either. The research shows only about a third to half of children are going to outgrow their picky eating without some kind of intervention. And that's when we talk about children are now moving into pediatric feeding disorder, is when those feeding challenges are significant enough that they've lasted for more than 2 years. When picky eating lasts for more than 2 years, it's not really picky eating. It's pediatric feeding disorder at that point in time. And with pediatric feeding disorder, the feeding challenges are significant enough that now how meal times go is being very impacted. How the child's growth is being impacted. The child's nutrition is being impacted. All of those things are going to be part of that pediatric feeding disorder. And when children have pediatric feeding disorder, there always is a physical basis to that. Something about the child's body is not working correctly. And of course, that can range across any of the seven areas of human function. And in pediatric feeding disorder, we talk about four major categories that we're going to be looking at. We're going to be looking at medical dysfunction. We're going to be looking at nutrition dysfunction. We're going to be looking at skill deficits or skill dysfunctions. And then we'll look at the psychosocial dysfunction as well. And so a child with pediatric feeding disorder typically is going to be demonstrating significant issues with eating, and they will have dysfunction in one or more of those four categories. A child who has ARFID, or what is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, which is a really long name, which is why everyone
Hence our
shortens it
fit.
to ARFID, ARFID, because it's such a long title, is a child who actually has normal eating skills, and something happens that causes them to develop anticipatory anxiety about eating. And so pediatric feeding disorder and ARFID are different. Pediatric feeding disorder is a physical medical issue. It is developmental is physical. Neurologic is physical. All of those things are physical. ARFID is a mental health disorder. And so that's one of the first important things to understand. And what we know is that if you have an older child, six, seven, eight, or above, who has never eaten well in their entire lifetime, who has been picky eater throughout their lifetime, who's had times of maybe their picky eating is worse sometimes, but it's always kind of their low level. They struggled from eating from the day they were born. That child likely does not have ARFID. That child likely has a pediatric feeding disorder that was not identified and never was treated. And we do know that children who have long-term chronic PFD who don't get it treated can shift into having ARFID, where the child has developed
An anxiety, yeah.
an anxiety issue about eating because all of their life, their experience has been that eating doesn't go well. And so that they do develop more anxiety over time. We know that ARFID can happen in isolation by itself. So there is a recent paper by Haley Estrom and a number of other authors that was released at the end of last year about looking at categories of PFD and ARFID. And we know that PFD can happen in isolation by itself. ARFID can happen in isolation by itself. We also know that PFD over time without correct treatment can shift into ARFID as well. And so those would be sort of the three major categories that we would be looking at. And a recent paper by Hannah Zickraff that came out in 2025 in about March really is trying to emphasize this piece in ARFID that is that anticipatory anxiety.
Yeah.
So an example of a child who was 100% normal, typical eater, and perhaps what happened is they had some kind of major injury to their mouth. They had to have a major procedure done in their mouth. They now develop a fear of pain of something happening in their mouth, and now they don't want to eat, and they develop this anticipatory anxiety. That would be ARFID happening in isolation.
So for parents at home who are trying to differentiate, it seems from the way that you're explaining it, actually it is quite clear that there are very clear differences. But I think a lot of, and I know, you know, I've been involved in a lot of groups around PFD and ARFID and the kind of trying to decide pathways, especially here in the UK, which we don't have, like diagnostic pathways. I think that what a lot of, you know, the concern is that we're going to have someone who's not, you know, got PFD or ARFID and, you know, end up diagnosed, or the other way around, that, you know, we're kind of, like you said, there's dismissing, they're fine, they grow out of it. As a parent at home, what exactly would you say are, like, I guess, the flags to go, you need to refer to one or the other?
So the first thing that I would think about is to look at how long the feeding problem has existed.
Okay.
And in fact, on our website, we do have a differential decision tree that is free and that people can access that would give some of these pathways that potentially children might go. So the first thing that I would suggest parents ask themselves is, how long has this feeding problem existed? If my child had a feeding issue from day one, right out of the gate, right out of the womb, that's a child that potentially has pediatric feeding disorder. And so that's the first thing that
the first port of call,
is how long it has this been going on. The other thing, of course, we're looking at is, how compromised is my child's nutrition? If their nutrition is not compromised at all, if their growth is not compromised at all, it's possible that it could just be picky eating. And if their nutrition is compromised, their growth is compromised, typically we're looking at pediatric feeding disorder. Now, one of the things we know as parents is sometimes our children's growth looks just fine because we take so much time out of our day and we expend so much energy to get our kids to eat something that our kids' growth looks okay because we're spending 12 hours a day
getting this
kid to eat enough. And so that's why I'm separating out growth and nutrition, because what happens sometimes is the growth looks okay, but it's because we're spending hours and hours and hours of getting adequate nutrition in them. And sometimes even with those hours, we're still not quite getting enough fruits and vegetables in them. We're not getting quite enough protein in them. They're growing, so when the doctor weighs and measures them, they look like they're just fine. But actually, when we look at their nutrition and the specifics of their nutrition, they have some deficiencies in vitamins and minerals, proteins, something along that line. Those are children that giving them a simple vitamin is not going to fix the issue. And so those children are going to be more PFD. So the next question I would ask parents to ask themselves is how long the feeding problem has been going on. If it's longer than 2 years, this is not picky eating anymore. This is pediatric feeding disorder. So when it's lasting that duration of time, the next thing we would look at is, are there skill deficits? That's going to be a little hard for the parents to figure out. But as parents, we actually do a pretty good job of being able to say, he just can't sit at the table very well. He doesn't seem to be able to feed himself very well. I don't think he's chewing up all his food exactly the way he should be. So, if those are some questions that are going on in the back of your head as a parent, your child may have a skill deficit. And that would be a time to think about getting a feeding assessment because those occupational therapists, the speech pathologists, they're going to be the ones who are going to help you be able to figure out if there's a skill deficit. And so, if your child, has a skill deficit, it's definitely pediatric feeding disorder. So the children who would have the ARFID would be the children who they did not have feeding problems right from the get-go. They don't have skill deficits. They typically have not had feeding problems for greater than 2 years duration. The children with ARFID, oftentimes you can identify some sort of precipitating event where they seem to eat really just fine until they had this
That
turning point.
time, yeah.
They had this injury, they had this surgery. And when you have pediatric feeding disorder, there's not generally the ability to identify a precipitating event. For most families, they had a suspicion their child wasn't eating that well, and maybe something happened that made it really noticeable, like they turned two. But they were doing just sort of kind of okay, not great. And then maybe something happened. But with ARFID, they really and truly were eating 100% normally until.
Until something happened. I think that's such a good define. Like, I've never heard it kind of said in such a clear-cut way. And I genuinely think a lot of parents will benefit from that because there's a lot of anxiety around it. I mean, your kind of advice to parents, so I guess what to do, if you're a parent at home who's struggling with eating, would the advice that you give be fairly kind of standard for all? What is the kind of advice you'd be giving it, especially in situations where you think it's PFD or ARFID? What can parents actually do at home?
So, interestingly enough, the very first intervention always is to look at your child's postural stability. And your child's ability to sit at the table in a stable, upright position and focus on eating, regardless of picky eating, typical eating, PFD, ARFID. Always the first thing we look at is postural stability. Because we talk about in the body's list of priorities, eating is not number one. The body's first priority is breathing. The body's second priority is not falling on your head. So protecting the brain is your body's second priority. And you only have so much motor brain power available at any one time. And if your motor brain is focusing on not falling on your head, so you're not posturally stable, you're not going to have enough motor brain power left over to make your mouth work correctly. And so always we start by getting a good seated position. And the correct seated position for children after about 10 months of age is what's called a 90-90-90 position. So your families have heard that before.
I hope they will, but do explain it.
90 degrees at the knees, 90 degrees at the ankles. So it means your child needs a footrest and they need to have, they're up high enough that the table surface hits halfway between the belly button and the breast nipple.
And it's the hips at 90, the knees at 90, and the ankles at 90.
Yes, exactly. So that's the first.
Okay, first protocol.
The second thing for families to do is to create a family meal routine. And that family meal should have a warning that the child's going to eat in 5 minutes, not go and grab them out of the middle of their play and plunk them in their chair. They need a warning so they can shift mental gears and physical gears. And part of that routine not only needs to include a warning, but then a transition activity, which is hand washing, which is a lovely hygiene habit to get your children into. And then when you come to the table, we want the children to come to the table with an empty plate on a placemat. We don't want families serving up a plate of food to their children. We need families to go back to family style serving. Family style serving will help your family tremendously because we want the children to have some time. You show them we're having spaghetti and meatballs. Here's the spaghetti. Everyone can take however much they want. If they don't want it on their plate, then we're going to use something we call a learning plate. And they can put it on an empty plate in the middle of the table and then pass the spaghetti to their sibling or your spouse or whoever's next in the family style serving. And even though they might not eat that food at that meal, they at least are learning about it because they've had an interaction with it. That family style serving is key. And then everybody eats, and the parents are good role models. At the end of the meal, there needs to be a clear ending part of your routine, some kind of cleanup that happens at the end. And the cleanup includes the child cleaning up whatever went on the learning plate. Sometime during the meal itself, parents need to teach about what went on the learning plate. It's not the ignoring plate. It's the learning plate. So parents need to do some teaching about it, and there needs to be some learning. So that family meal routine is going to be another key piece because remember, every meal is class. And so we need to make sure there's some learning happening at every meal. And then, of course, another important recommendation is there needs to be at least one of your child's preferred or safe foods
At
at
the
every
meal.
meal so that they have something that they can eat and have something that they know is safe for them to help bring down that stress, that potential anxiety.
Yeah, that's so interesting because that is absolutely what a lot of the advice I give. So, would you say that actually the advice, obviously, if someone's going and getting feeding support, it's going to be dependent on their individual child's needs and the situation. But would you say that generally those are all things that you would recommend, whether it's a child who's a little bit picky, whether it's a child who's got PFD, whether it's a child who's got ARFID?
Yes. I
I
would
love that.
actually make the exact same recommendations for a child who is completely neurotypical as well.
Yeah, love that.
These recommendations are the recommendations that the research in the field shows us
Okay, works.
children should be doing to develop a healthy lifelong relationship with food. And in our program, the SOS approach, we call these general treatment strategies.
Got you.
General treatment strategies is what we want every family who has a child
Doing.
on the planet to be doing with their child because it's what the research shows us is
Work.
what's best, how to teach children how, as I said, to have a healthy, lifelong relationship with food.
I love that. And for parents who have got to the state at the moment where they're just really anxious and they're overwhelmed with what's going on, I mean, I think those are such good points because none of them are really, really challenging. You know, you're doing stuff that is kind of every day. But what would you say to those parents who are really struggling with anxiety around the feeding and they've maybe had really negative experiences for years? What would be your, I guess, your support for them?
I think that's very difficult because even though it sounds like, you know, having good seating and a good mealtime routine is simple, it's actually not for some children and families where eating has become so negative, nobody wants to come to the table.
Yes, exactly.
And so, you know, the first thing is to figure out how is my family currently helping my child to come to the table because the parents may need to continue some of those things and build these interventions around that. So, for example, we know that many families, one of the ways they get their kids to the table is they give them the iPhone, they give them an iPad, they turn on the television. And for many families trying to implement a new program, they see it as all or nothing, that they have to do it 100% or they can't do it at all. And I would like to encourage your families to think about, let's start with what makes sense to you and what you can do. So if you're getting your child to come to the table by using the iPad, use the iPad, just incorporate it into that routine, and we'll work on weaning them off needing that. So the first thing is for families to try to understand and give themselves some permission to do it in steps and stages instead of having to do it perfectly. I think one of the things that makes us anxious as parents is we think we have to do everything right.
Yes. Perfectly.
We sort of have to cut ourselves a break, right? And we talk a lot in our program about there's a difference between ideal and real. And we have to start at what's real for your family.
Absolutely.
And we know what the ideal is. We can't start at ideal. We start at real and we move slowly to and get as far
Towards
to,
it. Yeah.
and most of us don't make ideal.
Exactly. I was going to say that. Most of us are not there.
It's okay, right? It's okay. I think some of the other things that are important for families to think about who are really feeling a lot of anxiety. We feel a lot of anxiety when we feel like our children's nutrition is really compromised, when we know they're not gaining weight well. And I would encourage those families, if they have the means to do it, to think about a consultation with a registered dietitian or a nutritionist. Or even just talk to the general practitioner about what is some nutrition coverage I might be able to give my child. So, is there a vitamin or mineral that I could give my child every day
That can help.
would be something that would help fill in the gaps that I know my child has? We're not big fans of using formula supplements for children who are past infancy, but that might help a family feel less
Option.
stressed.
Yeah, for sure.
If they know at the end of the meal, they're going to give their child 2 to 4 ounces of, you know, some kind of nutrition supplement, and that makes them feel less anxious, then let's
That
do
might be the option. And do you
that.
think these families, ideally, if they are worried and if they're, you know, like you said, there are the kind of conditions where it does sound like it's PFD or often, they need to be going and seeking support from a, like you said, a registered dietitian and registered nutritionist, feeding specialist in the UK to get support with this because there's a lot going on and we shouldn't be expected as parents to completely take that on. Would you agree with that?
Very, very much so. I like to encourage families to do what they think they can do at home first and really try to give it a good try for 2 to 4 weeks. And if you're not seeing any changes at all, then You need to seek additional
Okay,
help.
that's really good. That's a good, goalpost.
Yeah, and I know that sometimes in the UK, getting access to services can be challenging. So an option for parents to consider is, do they maybe try to set up an appointment with a feeding specialist? And while they're waiting to get into that feeding specialist is when they try these other things
Okay.
that they
Yeah.
really
Put those
work
things in
on,
place. Yeah.
giving it a good try.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really good way to think about it. And I think obviously it's going to be different in the UK to the US as well. But I mean, the services aren't, we haven't got a lot here. And we, there's so much more that needs to be done to support parents in these situations because we really don't have a lot of support. So, getting in there, it's going to be a wait. So I think you're absolutely right. Put some changes into place in the meanwhile.
Right. The other thing I'm going to encourage your families to do is we do have a free 2.25 hour workshop on our website. Any family can go and take that workshop, and it's going to review in more detail what you and I just talked about. It's going to talk about some additional general treatment strategies that families can do beyond postural stability and the mealtime routine. The other big one is some kind of a feeding schedule can be very helpful to work on appetite conditioning. And all of those things will be explained in that workshop. And
That's
that's a really good thing for families to do, especially if they do have to wait to
okay.
get to
To
some
get
kind
some
of
support.
service.
That's great. That's really good to know. So I'm wrapping up now, but I've just got one last question, which is what is one bit of, I guess, advice or, I guess, take home from parent? What's one thing you would say really they need to do to try and make a difference, I guess?
I think the biggest things that families can do is to, before each meal, do a little mini mental health check with yourself.
Love
And so when you're taking out the food, when you're standing at the stove, when you're, some part of your mealtime prep routine, take that big breath, and just say, can I go into this meal happy, calm, collected? And we tell parents, because you got to put on your happy face when you get to this meal. And if you say to yourself, I cannot possibly do this another time today, it's time to punt this meal and maybe go out to eat. It's time to give yourself permission to go and have a picnic on the back porch. It's time for you to
Break
break
out breakfast
all the
meal.
rules and eat your meal in front of the television.
Love that.
You have to come to the meal as best you can, calm, collected, and with a happy face. And if you simply cannot do that,
You need to
don't
do something
try.
else. Yeah, I love that. That's such a good
Give
point.
yourself permission to ha have a break. And hopefully most of the time you're going to be able to say, yes, I can do this. And but if you can't, be nice to yourself.
Love
I think as
that.
parents, we're so hard on ourselves.
So tough, so tough. Oh, I thought that was honestly so helpful. I think so many parents will really, really benefit. And I love the fact that you've got all these resources as well. So thank you for being on. I'm desperate to do your SOS feeding training. I've been trying for 2 years and I just can't ever get on because it sells out every time I get to it. But I will. I'll get on there one day. But I'm so grateful, honestly. Thank you for joining us and sharing all your wisdom. It's been fascinating. And I can't wait to listen back to it, genuinely.
Thank you for the opportunity. This
Oh,
is
not at all.
wonderful to be able to reach your parent audience. That's
Amazing.
fantastic for
And
us.
keep up all of the work you're doing because you're very, very well known in the UK. I actually had someone I was talking to earlier about neurodivergence and nutrition, and she mentioned you and your course. So you are incredibly well known in the UK. So keep up all the work that you're doing. It's brilliant. And thank you again for coming on. I'm very, very grateful.
Yeah, and good luck to all your families.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate that. Take care. Have a lovely day. Thank you so much, Kay, for the incredible insight into the developmental stages of eating and sharing all of the fantastic work that you have done with the SOS approach to feeding. If you guys enjoyed today's episode, please do subscribe, share it with a friend, or leave a quick review, as it really, really makes such a big difference. This podcast is brought to you with support from Little Dish, so a huge thank you to them for hosting us in their headquarters as well. And finally, make sure you stay tuned for my next episode. This episode of How to Feed wouldn't have been possible without my sponsors, Little Dish. Their meals are fresh, delicious, and made with ingredients that you would find in your own kitchen, making them a brilliant option for busy days.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.